podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome back to Tennis Unfiltered with me, James Gray of iNews.co.uk and the iNewspaper. I've got George Belshaw and Calvin Betton. Calvin's sporting a different retro United shirt. What year is this, Calvin?
This is 1985.
That is old.
United won the FA Cup. These kits, the 1985 kits, were the first football kits I ever bought. I mean, it's not the exact same kit, but as when I was seven. But they were the first. They were the first football kits I ever bought. The 1985 home, away, and third kits.
All three.
I didn't buy them all at once. I know I had them all, and then, as anything with COVID, when COVID came and we were just all bored, I just started buying up old Man United tops that I used to have. So,
George, what's the first Villa kit you had?
Oh, God, that's a hard question. I remember having, I don't know if it would have been my first, but I remember having an NTL Peter Schmeichel goalkeeper kit when he came to Villa.
Wow.
It was like a sky blue one.
So you haven't even got the old JVC Paul Merson kits.
So I did get versions of that. I had an old AST computer kit as well. So I probably had an older version, but I'm not sure if the NTL one was maybe the first. I can't remember. But my friend was actually messaging me randomly about Peter Schmeichel yesterday, saying that he was Aston Villa's oldest goal scorer for two decades until
Aston
scored last year. So it's quite a good quiz question.
Do people buy tennis kits in the same way they buy football kits? I know suppliers wish they did, but I'm not.
Yeah, I mean they used to, and some of the Agassi gear, some of the 1990s gear for a few players, Agassi, Edberg, Sampras, that goes for quite a bit on eBay now. Mm. If anyone's got any,
good to know. Just check in the attic for old Agassi kits. Right, we're going to start with a couple of questions this week because the mailbag has been overflowing for some time.
There is just on that. I've just remembered that there is a guy I follow on Amazon who is just obsessed with Agassi kit, and he plays tennis. But he posts videos, but every time he plays in a full era of Adidas of Agassi gear and the rackets as well. He'll go and play with his mates, and he'll go as 92 Agassi, and he'll have the pink Donne and all the gear that he wore then. And then other days he'll come and he's got some random ones, come 96, and it always matches it with the rackets and the shoes.
Does he change the hair for each Agassi era as well?
No, he wears the cap or the bandana, but he doesn't. It's exact. It's bizarre. I mean, he's not very good at tennis, but he always films his ear. He puts his GoPro behind the behind the court and always films himself.
Did you say you follow him on Amazon?
On Instagram.
Oh, right. Okay.
I might have said Amazon, but I meant Instagram.
How does one follow someone on Amazon? Guess if they have a shop, maybe.
I'm going to find this guy's name now, just in case anybody... Excellent. Wait a minute.
And now that you've said he's not very good at tennis, hopefully
he
suffering.
Might get a load of followers. Might have helped him out there.
While Calvin's doing that, James, shall I cheekily plug my fun charity thing I'm going to do for next week?
Far away, notes?
Have you all been spammed with this as well on Twitter? I think I've been spammed with this.
Yeah, I'm sure you've
months.
Mentioned it.
Yeah. So next month, I'm, as injuries aside, planning to do 100 press-ups every day in April. Yeah. It's for cancer research, and I'll send James a link to my Just Giving thing. And
how many press-ups do you think you can currently do?
So I reckon I can do probably 30 in one go. So I'll be able to do the 100 in probably 3.5 break rounds, I think. But obviously by the end of the month, I'll aim to do 100 in one go.
And that sounds absolutely exhausting. I think of nothing worse.
Yeah, I think it'll be horrible. I really, really hate press-ups. So, yeah, that should be your motivation to sponsor.
The guy, by the way, is called Alka, A-L-K-A dot Monaco. Alka dot Monaco. And he basically just posts Agassi gear from, like, his era.
All right. Well, he's got, well, at least one new follower straight off the bat. So, as someone who's currently reading Andre Agassi's autobiography, yeah. I'm very nearly finished it. It's getting good. It's getting very meth heavy. Nice. Which, I mean,
you're reading it or listening to it?
I'm audiobooking it while I'm doing my long runs because I'm running a half marathon.
Don't you think you might have got there now. Don't you think it gets a little bit soppy?
Yeah, like I've got a heart of like flesh and blood, not stone like you, Calvin. Like,
yeah, but he goes on a bit much, though. It's like a little bit much.
Yeah.
There's the weirdest bit in it is when, and I can't think it's just not a lie, when there's the bit where he says that when his and Steffi Graf's dads both met, they start having a fight in the garden. Or something. And I just think that's just got to be made up.
I think, yes, there's an element of creative license when you write your own autobiography that you can say what you like. No one's going to contradict you. But, yeah, it's a good read, if nothing else.
Yeah, I enjoyed it when I read it.
Right, let's start with a question from the mailbox. If you want to send us an email, it's tennisunfiltered@gmail.com. And that is exactly what Matt has done. Matt says, I've just finished watching Andy Murray's dramatic win over Matteo Berrettini. Granted, the Italian was rusty and has clearly had health issues in the second, but it struck me as one of Murray's best performances of the year so far. Maybe that's not a high benchmark. He was tactically sound, came into the net effectively, got more attacking as the match went on. Anyway, to the point of this email, it was another terrific topsy-turvy match between these two. They always seem to be involved in real humdingers and bring out the best of each other. Sadly, due to Berrettini's fitness issues, their meetings have been few and far between. Given Murray's impending departure from the game, we may not see many more. However, on the back of recent conversations you've had about two good matchups, I wonder if there is a pairing around at the moment that consistently delivers better matches than these two when on court together. When you see Murray and Berrettini due to play each other, it's appointment viewing. It's always exciting and tight with no clear favourite. For me, maybe through my Murray-tinted spectacles, there are a few matches I'd rather watch. Interested to hear your thoughts. Keep up the good work. Love listening. Thanks, Matt, for your email. George, I'm putting you on the spot first. Pairings that can beat Murray Berrettini for guaranteed entertainment?
I mean, I know Calvin will say we'll get bored of this eventually, but for me, the matchup I'm looking forward to most at the minute when I see it built up is Alcaraz v. Sinner. I'm really enjoying that. I think that's a good kind of mix of styles and excitement. And to be honest, any Djokovic match against those guys as well, I'm really up for. They're the matches that are really kind of drawing me in on the men's side at the minute. That said, there is like a certain quality to a Murray match. And I do think, I'm not sure I would necessarily say Berrettini's the only one who kind of brings this out of him, but Berrettini feels like quite a beatable big name player who, you know, has had his own problems, who does play a style that is very different to Murray's, and he does have like weaknesses in his game that Murray can kind of get to. So it feels like always a winnable big match, I suppose, for Murray, even though, you know, Berrettini, as I've said, hasn't really been kind of the player he was for a little while now. So yeah, I mean, I think it's always a good match and it's always an interesting map of styles. I think any big hitter against guys like Murray has traditionally been quite good. And, you know, I don't know.
Raonic is a good example. They had quite a lengthy rivalry. Yeah, and they were, you know, it was sometimes one-sided, but I think they played 15 times or something.
Yeah, I mean, Raonic, I remember, like, one of the first tournaments I ever covered was, like, when he was kind of becoming number three in the world at the ATP Finals. He played a couple of belters against Murray and Djokovic in that tournament, and, you know, that style really kind of matched up well, like brilliant server versus returner, and, you know, Raonic was taking the ball really well. So yeah, I mean, I don't know, I actually think there probably are loads more examples of like matches I probably would tune into more than any Murray match at the minute in some ways, but like the fact it's Murray's personality, he kind of brings the match to his level. It doesn't, almost doesn't matter who he's playing, even though I think there's like actual matches I'd much rather watch from the perspective of like, ooh, I don't know who's going to get the better of this from a kind of pure tennis perspective. Murray is just quite drama, isn't he, really?
I guess it's also, you need the flawed nature of it, right? Like, if you had, you know, it's what I know about Djokovic often, or Max Verstappen or Michael Schumacher, people got bored of, because it's like, well, they're just steamrolling people. It's not that interesting. Calvin, you've got a particular match up when you see an order of play, you make sure you stay up late to watch it?
I think not so much anymore. I do think for the minute, I think Sinner and Alcaraz is great viewing. And I think it's got just enough variation that maybe it doesn't go that way. Like Alcaraz plays, like he plays his drop shots and that kind of thing. And, you know, I think it's got a bit, you know, and I think they're both still figuring each other out, which is good. Murray Berrettini, I think Murray matches are always really interesting when he plays somebody who has a huge weapon and quite a gaping weakness. Because it's just a case of, like, does their weapon, because he's always going to play pretty passive in general. Like, he likes to solve problems and that kind of thing. So can their huge weapon get through his defence? And can he find their weakness enough times? And I think that's always been quite interesting, him doing that. So, yeah, I mean, I thought last night's match against Mahatch was an excellent match. I still worry, like, just going a little bit off topic with Berrettini. I wonder, like, again, like, I know he had a good week the week before, and, you know, he seems injury free now. And if you haven't seen him in person, I don't see how he's going to continue and not keep getting injured with his body shape. It is bizarre because he's a huge guy, both in height and his upper body, he's huge, and he's got the skinniest legs you could ever come across. And I'm kind of like, it's kind of a joke, but I don't see how somebody who's going to play the style he plays with the size of him. It's a different thing, I think, with, say, Christopher Eubanks, who's got skinny legs, but he's also quite a skinny guy in the top half, and he's not going to be running around the court sprinting loads. And even when he does have to change direction, there's not loads of weight and momentum going one way. Whereas the way that Berrettini plays, and I don't know whether this has always been the case, whether his legs have always been that skinny, but I don't see how he's, without putting significant muscle on there, how he's not going to keep getting lower body injuries.
I always, kind of speaking of Berrettini's injury record, I was always like astonished, like he had such a big abdominal problem. Like, he has the best abs I've ever seen in my entire life. They're actually incredible. How can they ever be injured? Like, totally get your point about the legs, but like, what the hell? Like, when that injury came up and kept recurring, that's madness.
Well, I mean, I suppose if you're thinking about the body shape, and just from, I'm no biomechanicist, but I've spoken to a lot of biomechanicists, and they talk a lot about ab injuries because there's not, I think, the understanding about, you know, people, when your hamstring goes, people kind of know why, and they're like, well, you need more flexibility, you need more core strength, and like build this up and that. But with ab injuries, they can so often be recurring and kind of a bit mysterious. You know, Draper's had loads of them. Obviously, Berrettini's had loads of ab injuries. And I always think with those guys, yeah, top heavy and bottom light, the torsion that is involved there, and like your legs aren't giving you the same support, but your upper body is putting so much kind of torsion through that area of the body. It's not a surprise that your abs are giving up because, you know, you haven't got all the muscle in the right place. It's kind of what you're saying, Calvin, but it's also, I know, often to do with overuse, and it's an injury that, like, people often get recurrent through their careers who've maybe played too much too young, which is not something we necessarily associate with Matteo Berrettini. Like, I can't think that he was that young when he made his breakthrough, and he's like 27 now, so he's been around quite a long time.
He's also interesting speaking, like, from a biomechanical point of view, which does often lead to injuries in a player, that he's not the most biomechanically sound player. He doesn't have, like, his backhand's a little bit awkward, obviously. His forehand, though he can hit it huge, is very army. There is, you know, there's a lot of torque and weight going through his arm. It's not
better
like
than a navy forehand.
Sorry?
Better than a navy forehand.
Terrible pun.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
It's all right. I'll just put him on mute. It's easier.
You said he's got an army forehand.
Oh, wow.
He could have gone for Aria. Christ.
You know, maybe that is something to do with it. And I know that when people talk about technique a lot of the time, and they'll say things like, and I've had this conversation with players where I go, you know, I don't like that technique. They'll go, oh, well, it's working, isn't it? It's like, well, it's working now, but is it going to lead to issues later on? You know, and I think that's always something that, you know, with Berrettini, he's got, I think there's a lot of red flags there that I'm not sure we'll ever see him consistently playing full seasons unless something changes.
While we're on Murray and just not sure. Hopefully I'm not getting in the way of your kind of great planning of the episode, James. But it was quite an emotional farewell, wasn't it, in some ways, from that kind of Miami match, in a way not really seen from Murray, even though he's been talking about kind of going. Like, this was the first one that felt, oh, wow, he's kind of properly really going out of his way to say goodbye here, and kind of spoke to that a little bit afterwards as well.
Yeah, I think the quotes afterwards are very indicative and very interesting. He said, I wasn't thinking about all the matches I played, just more that that's the last match I'm going to play here, which is sad because I love it here. And obviously, for people who don't know, like, Andy Murray used to have a flat in Miami. He would always do his winter training block there. It's somewhere he's... actually, funnily enough, when Dicko died, one of the photos that I'd never seen was of him and Andy Murray jogging along the beach in Miami as part of a press thing, which I thought was great. He was actually looking quite sprightly, to be fair. It wasn't that long ago. But I thought it was interesting because Murray, you know, he hasn't done the thing that lots of people have done, which is said, this is the date I'm going, but he's sort of said, well, yeah, I'm off. And now it's like the shackles are off a bit. Not that he's playing with more freedom, but that he can sort of say it, and that he can say, yeah, well, actually, this is quite emotional because I'm not going to be back here. And I think that's nice. And like, to hear him say, I'm looking forward to the end now, to giving my best the next few months and then get to be at home with my family. Like, we've often joked about like how Andy Murray seems desperate to spend time away from his children, but it's not true. He clearly loves his kids, and anyone who's seen how much he dresses up on social media knows that he's a very committed dad. And it must be really painful to spend so much time away from a young family, even if it does mean you get a bit more sleep than you might otherwise.
Do we still actually believe him though, that he will retire? And this is
I think there's still a chance he won't.
If I actually was thinking, I was speaking to someone today, and they said, oh, well, I didn't sleep much last night because I sat up watching Andy, and I was thinking, if he'd won that match, you know, fourth round of Miami, and then maybe won one more. You can guarantee there'd have just been this like eyebrow flickering up and down, like getting off the court, talking to his coach, and he's like, hey, quarterfinals, hey.
Well, I think it's I do think it's one of those. I think if his form hadn't picked up as it was, he already has picked up quite a bit, I think. And I thought last night he played excellent. But I think if he hadn't have done that, then I think, yeah, he was almost certain. But I was watching him both in his two matches that he won and in this one last night, and I still don't know Andy all that well at all, but I know him a very small bit, and I still don't know how he's going to let this go. And I think it's the same way, I say it the same with Nadal and that kind of thing. And if I'm honest, I'd advise him to not let it go. Because, you know, he's still... And I don't know, that might not be just in singles. It might be, you know, maybe he takes up doubles. Maybe... It wouldn't surprise me, for example, if he stops after Wimbledon or the Olympics, and then next year he decides he wants to have a crack at playing doubles. And it doesn't have to be with his brother, but there's some records there, you know, that are there for him. There's, you know, he could certainly become it, and there's... I think we've not had somebody who's won a slam at singles and at doubles for about 30 years. I think Michael Stick was the last one. Michael Stick and John McEnroe won Wimbledon, I think, in 92. I don't think there's been a player who's won a slam at singles and another slam at doubles. And I don't think there's been a world number one in both for about the same amount of time since McEnroe.
That's a great Edberg, maybe. That's a great question. If anyone's got one,
I think Edberg might be the last one who's been world number one. I don't know if he won number one at doubles. He won a slam at doubles.
I'm just sort of like glancing my eyes through the Grand Slam winners. It's easy in the 21st century because just the same four blokes. But I can't imagine Goran Ivanišević play much doubles.
No,
I can imagine
no,
it would
never.
Have been a nightmare on a doubles court.
No.
Marit Safin never won a doubles.
No. I think it's Edberg. It's Edberg or Stick, whoever won it last. Edberg's won slams. Stick's won slams. And Stick won one with McEnroe. So,
even if it did make two French Open finals in the doubles, but lost
really?
Them both.
Really? Right.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I think it's,
for me, and I say this to, I'd say it to Andy, but I say this to all players when they're thinking about stopping, that once you stop, you never get Once you decide, he stops now. He'll only have about another 4 or 5 years where he has a chance of actually being in a serious competitive environment, whether that be singles or doubles. And then after that, you never get it. It's done then. You don't get the opportunity. So whether he fancies that, I don't know, but it wouldn't surprise me if he did. Or if he thinks, you know, if he might do what, you know, it's like the same thing as, I mean, it's a bit different in ages and ages of his kids and that. But remember Alex Ferguson, when he announced his retirement, the first time that he was going to stop, and then he said he just figured, well, what am I going to do? Like, you know, so I'm not got anything that I want to do. So, you know, he might want to spend time with his kids and that kind of thing. But I think if his body's fine, he might think, like, you know, I miss the tour. And I don't think it has to be straight away. It might have a year off and come back. And he can go, you know, go to Louis Kaye to teach me how to play doubles.
I would suggest, Calvin, that if you get the chance, please don't tell Murray that stat about no one's won a singles and doubles. Like, I can't take it. Like, I can't take a comeback and then the blood pressure that Andy Murray raises. I couldn't cope. But I do agree with you. I think if he got that idea in his head, I mean, one of the things people might underestimate about Andy Murray is he's so single-minded.
Yeah.
And that when he gets hold of a thought, you know, to a fault, he will just, you know, like a dog with a bone, he will chew it down and down and down.
And I think a challenge, you know, it's a challenge for him to go at. And like I said, once you get to, he's going to be what is he now? Is he 36 now?
He's what, a week, he's nearly 37.
Yeah, he's 37 then, right? But he's not going to be able to do that when he's, I know Bob Pan has just done it, but that's, he's been playing all the time. You can't come back in 4 or 5 years' time. I think it would have to be, he could maybe have a year and then decide it's something he wants to do, and he's probably not going to do singles. But, and what's the, I think the thing was before, what was always put to me before as the reason why he wouldn't, because I know when, remember a few years ago when he first had the hip injury, and a lot of people going, well, maybe he'll come back and just play doubles, there was the idea that he wouldn't be able to handle being around the tournaments, the big tournaments, while all his peers from previously, Federer, Nadal, Djokovic, Wawrinka and all those guys were there playing singles and still winning them, and he's just like, he's playing doubles on the outside courts. We're not far off that not being the case at all. If Nadal goes this year, Federer's already gone, Stan's not in the back end of slams anymore, Djokovic maybe got a year of it left, like, so that maybe goes out the window then. He thinks, well, I can, and I do understand that, why he didn't want to do that, but, you know,
maybe could give him a call, see if he fancies a link up with Henry.
Henry's starting a new partnership next week, so we don't need a new partner.
Can you officially reveal that on the air yet, Calvin?
Well, yeah, he's going to be playing with Harry Heliavara for the clay, and hopefully for a long time after that.
Where are they starting off next week?
They'll be in Marrakesh, and I will be going.
Oh, great. Have you been to Marrakesh before?
No, I've not.
It's an absolutely amazing place.
Yeah, well, they didn't know where they were going to go. Somebody told me last week, because I knew I was going, they were like, oh, Henry and Harry got in Estoril. And I was like, all right, yeah, great. That, you know, and I'm sure Estoril is really nice, but
I've been to
Portugal a lot, you know. Yeah. It's like, but, yeah.
It's really a surfing haven, Estoril. Like, it's just north of Lisbon on the coast, and there's amazing surfing and some very good golf courses up there as well. But yeah, you'd much rather Marrakesh. In fact, yeah, the last time I was there, I was staying in the Four Seasons, so it was pretty spectacular.
So we'll see that they're going to start that, and then they'll play the full clay and the grass, I would think. And then, you know, I'm hoping it goes a lot longer than that. And I think if they're successful, then it will. But
great. Great news. Looking forward to a new partnership. And, of course, a much harder name to spell. There are more A's in Heliavara than I'd care to shake a stick at.
Yeah, so. Yeah. And probably a good moment too. I told you guys earlier about this. Luke's in Mexico at the minute, and the situation with the courts in Mexico.
So, yeah, I saw where you posted that they're going to water them like every 5 games or something.
After the warm-up, every 5 games, and at the end of each set as normal.
These are clay courts for clarity.
And bear in mind that you normally water a clay court after each set, and that's it.
So what does that suggest? That it's very windy? That the courts
both. It's very windy, and the courts are just very dry. There's some, like, some clay courts are just like that. The drainage is almost like they don't drain properly, and by that I mean they drain too well. Mm. They don't hold their water, and if that's the case, you can't stand up on them. The courts are too fast. It's also a It's also an altitude at San Patoshi, I think it's pronounced. Or San Luis Potosi, I think it's the place is pronounced. So altitude, I don't know whether that dries it out more or what have you. But yeah, the courts apparently they're not good, and it's really windy. And I turned on today to have a look at it, and the live stream behind was blowing all over the camera was blowing all over. Would make you feel a little bit sick if you're watching it, because like the camera is just constantly moving, and there's trees in behind the court. There's some huge trees, and they're basically at 90 degrees. I think it was 42 mile an hour winds while they were playing today.
Great. Well, Luke and Skander top seeds there, I see.
Yeah.
The newly crowned African Games champion, Skander Mansouri, I believe.
Well, I mean, he did. He won the African Games. But in the first match, I mean, Luke's 6'1", I think, and he's going to be an absolute midget, because Skander, I think, is about 6'4", and they play Bellier and Hoosler, who are both 6'5". And then the next round, after if whoever wins that one, I think they get their lad Mpets Perikard.
Mpetshi Perica, he is enormous.
Who's 6'8", apparently. So, like, that's a very tall section of the draw up there.
Not great in the wind, Cowan. I think that the big lads will struggle in the wind.
Yeah, maybe. Wind and altitude. Got some work to do there, haven't we?
Yeah. Right, let's move on to our next question. Thanks very much to Matt for that one. This one comes from Danny. Says, when I read the news about a possible move of a WTA tournament to Queens, I think I shared the opinion of most British tennis fans that it would be a big step back. Apart from the concentration of events in London, for those fans who've been to all the British tournaments, the consensus is that Queens is the least value for money and has the worst fan experience. You do get some great players, but the tickets can cost more than the equivalent for a round at Centre Court for Wimbledon, while the venue is incredibly small and cramped, making it hard to leave your seats at any time, and many have felt an attitude, if you're not part of the £15,000 private members club or sitting in a hospitality seat, you're not really welcome. Compare it to a tournament like Nottingham, which is amazing to visit, it is far more welcoming. You can easily wander around the grounds, taking in multiple matches, and has very reasonable ticket prices. I understand the need for successful and profitable tournaments, but this would be a big step back. I don't know how much. I mean, I think we largely agree with it, or at least some of us do. But it's good to hear it from outside the pod, Calvin. That you know, it's not necessarily a place that fans love to go, even if they do sell out.
Yeah, I mean, I actually enjoyed the tournament. It's a different experience for me. Like the players' area is very nice, and you know, you're kind of separated. There is, I can't think of a tournament I've been to where there is a bigger ratio of corporate to non-corporate. From where I was, it felt like the place was like 70% corporate who were there. The corporate area is huge at Queen's. And the little gangways that you walk to the courts, they're not that big. And so the actual areas where there's non-corporate people, I don't want to really call them normal people.
Normies.
There don't seem to be a lot of them there. But and then, you know, it's obviously in a very la-di-da part of London as well. So which maybe doesn't help with the stigma that tennis has about it.
I think what's interesting is I've spoken to a few people about this recently, and there is like a feeling that the members don't love the tournament because it is let's face it, if you're paying those whacking membership fees, you want to get bang for your buck, and the tournament it does turn Queens into a building site for people who've not been there. Queens Club is a lovely place outside of the tournament, and while it's still quite cool during the tournament, there's a hell of a lot of temporary stands up and all the hoardings, and it does get a bit mad. Whereas if you put another tournament in, you're not really adding any infrastructure there. Like, the infrastructure's all there anyway. It only has to be up for an extra week, and let's face it, it's up for about 6 weeks anyway. But you're making a bit more money, you get a bit more tennis and this, that and the other. So I can see that there is also some political pushing and pulling going on there. But we would welcome, if other people have thoughts or perspectives on a WTA event at Queen's in the summer, the week before the men's tournament, then we'd welcome your input, tennisunfiltered@gmail.com. Right, last question we're going to do today. It's a long one. It's so long that it features the phrase, stay with me on this one. It's from Nick, who says, just listened to the latest pod, found myself agreeing with you about everything you were saying, the letdown that was Breakpoint. Stay with me on this one. I thought Calvin gave some great insight into what would make a successful show, the players we could relate to, struggle to make a living, etc. Got me thinking about a documentary that was aired on Channel 4 about 30 years ago that followed young British players around for a year or so that were based at Bisham Abbey. Go back and listen to our podcast about that. I can't remember all the player names or indeed the documentary name, but it featured a very young James Trotman playing some junior stuff and a couple of female players transitioning from the juniors to the main tour, Zoe Mellis and Frances Hearn, mixing it with the likes of Navratilova at a pre-Wimbledon Futures tournament in 1993, whilst being coached by former Grand Slam finalist Olga Morozova in a questionable shell suit. The fashion at the time, I guess. As a 13-year-old just getting into tennis, I found it fascinating as it was a world away from the glitz and glamour of what you normally get to see by watching Wimbledon and the Slams, pretty much the only tennis on normal TV at the time, and played a huge part in tennis becoming my hobby. The players featured were relatable, there were no egos, they were normal people, and the drama was all about the struggle to make it in a very tough sport. Got me thinking about the ups and downs of tennis, and was thinking that Marcus Willis would make a great story for a documentary. Of course, there was the dream run in 2016, where he and his turquoise tracksuit jacket, a lot of tracksuits getting slagged off here, I won't hear a word against them, and pocketed £50,000 for 2 weeks' work. That gets the attention from the viewers. He has an interesting history. He's then unable to back that run up due to injury, retires, does a bit of coaching, comes back as a doubles player, and actually, I notice, is the number two seed in Mexico, where Luke and Skander are playing this week with Christian Harrison, I believe. He set up a GoFundMe page to help with his costs to realise his dream once again. I appreciate I'm pitching an idea for a documentary and not a Hollywood motion picture. The contrast between what could have been and the current reality would make for compelling viewing. Anyway, would love to know if you think this would make a better watch and would engage with viewers more so than the privileged tripe we've been subjected to with Breakpoint. Oh, and does Calvin remember that documentary? Not sure what happened to Zoe and Francis or if Olga still wears her shell suit, but I hear James has a small role with a promising young British player. I don't know what that means. I'm slightly concerned. I don't have any roles with any promising British players. Anyway, love the pod, fellas. Keep up the great work. Thanks, Nick. Calvin, this documentary about Bisham Abbey and about Channel 4 about 30 years ago should be right up your street.
Yeah, first of all, I don't know where you've pulled that stuff from. Marcus Willis out from James. He's not even playing in Mexico.
Is he not? I thought I saw him on the entry list. Or maybe he was on the entry list in Marrakesh. According to the entry list I have, he's playing in Mexico City.
It's not in Mexico City.
Oh, sorry.
That's next week. Yeah.
Okay.
Where was that? Yeah, I do remember that documentary, actually. It was, I mean, a couple of my friends were in it. So Dan Kiernan was in it, who now is at one of our podcast rivals.
Yeah. Bitter podcast rivals.
Trotz was in it. One of my best mates, Andy Banks, was, I don't know whether he was actually in it. He definitely went to Bisham, but it might have been just a little bit before he went. There was a famous scene where I think they were running round the grounds and James Auckland, who became a very good doubles player when he was about 14, was throwing up, and like there was almost a little bit of bullying going on from the fitness coach, who was a guy called Steve Green, who used to work with Tim Henman as well. But yeah, I do remember it. I think it was just a one-off. I think it was maybe just 1 hour, but it was quite good.
Do you have any idea what happened to Zoe and Francis?
I don't. Mellis, I mean, Francis, I know the names. I'd completely forgot about them, so I'm not sure really what happened to them. There was another one like about 15 years ago as well called, it wasn't specifically about tennis, I think it was called Trophy Parents or something. And it was about I think there were five families whose parents were basically obsessed with the sport, I think there was a golfer, a boxer, there were two tennis players. Eden Silver was on it, who was one of them. I'm trying to think who the other one was.
Is that Eden Silver who now goes out with Liam Brody?
Yeah, that's Eden, yeah. She was on it, and there was another tennis player, and I can't remember who it was. I did remember 2 minutes ago, and it's complete loss of me. But that was really interesting. I think that was like maybe a three-parter or something. But again, it was a really good program. Like, and you know, it was interesting to see how the different parents in different sports react. And you know, I think they did get one who was quite normal, and then they got some who were crazy as well. I can't remember the. I think it was called Trophy Parents or something.
Okay, see if we can find it somewhere in the archives. I think probably the answer to the question, would the Marcus Willis documentary be a better watch? I mean, almost certainly. Like, you know, I know Marcus is sometimes Marmite on tour, but Like, he is an interesting story. There's no questioning that.
I mean, I don't know if you could have it just on him, but I think he's, again, he's one of those, like, he just plays doubles now. He's one of those guys who would fit into a bigger narrative of different types of characters and that kind of thing, who would make a good show, I think. I really do think that. But what I don't get is, like, this is not necessarily just on tennis to do this. I don't, you know, there's nothing stopping some independent documentary makers pitching this idea to Netflix or something, or say, we're going to do this. And doesn't have to be. I think that was half the problem with Breakpoint. It felt like it was the ATP and WTA's, like, baby, if you will, that they'd put it together. This is why we wanted to do it. And as always, with certainly with the WTA and usually with the ATP, they somehow managed to cock up an open goal.
Yeah, indeed. Well, thanks for your email, Nick. And if anyone finds the Channel 4 documentary, the name, I mean, if we get the name, I might be able to get it out of the archives because I do a few contacts at Channel 4. But it probably is on YouTube somewhere in the back.
It was on YouTube. I mean, I remember, like, when, you know, I'm probably talking 15 years ago now, somebody who I knew pulled it out. I can probably find out. I can ask Trotz what it was called.
Yeah.
Because he'll know.
Speaking of kind of rogue old Channel 4 tennis documentaries, one of my favourite ones is of the, which we may have talked about on here before, but just in case we haven't, there's one like that followed the WTA tour around for a bit, and John Dolan,
right?
A great feature of him just like going to buy like lots of suits randomly from lots of shops, and it really was just a wonderful watch. Like, it's just so classic.
Kind
of,
quite esoteric, like, I hear. I didn't see it, but
oh, it's on YouTube. It's brilliant. Well worth a watch.
The problem with tennis in like media and like in documentaries and also in films is it just seems to cock it up so much, like all the time. Like, there have been quite a few tennis films, like Wimbledon. Remember that absolute travesty?
Yeah, was that with Paul Bettany and Kirsten Dunst?
But the crazy thing was with that, right, was that Paul Bettany was in it and Kirsten Dunst, yeah, like you said, and they got two good mates, well, a really good mate of mine, Jason Torpy, and they got, I forget who the other one was, they got another tennis player at the time to basically be the doubles and the body doubles for when they were playing tennis. And the idea was that they would play. And because these guys were both very good tennis players. They would play, and then, you know, that you never see the face of them as it happened, and, you know, it would make the tennis look like basically like a tennis match should be. And they did it. They went and filmed it. They got paid and everything. And then the directors decided they weren't going to do that. They were just going to have Paul Bettany and the other guy playing. Yeah. And it was supposed to be the Wimbledon final. And it was like, these guys were absolute donkeys. And it's like, how have you somehow managed to mess this up? And there was that one. There was the McEnroe Borg one that was supposed to be, you know, it got quite a bit of hype at the time. It had, did it have Miles Teller in it? Was it Miles Teller or, yeah, I think Miles Teller played McEnroe, I think.
Wasn't it?
Or was no, it not Miles.
Lord of the Rings guy, wasn't it?
No, the other guy, the guy who played Indiana Jones' son in the crap Indiana Jones. What's he called? Shia LaBeouf. Shia LaBeouf.
Shia LaBeouf. That's
yeah,
it.
Not, that's it. Yeah,
that's what I meant.
But yeah, so he played McEnroe. But again, it was okay. But they chose like a weird storyline to have it, where I think it was all before the first time they ever played, and that's where the film began and ended. It was very niche, very indie, and it was like the Borg section was entirely in Scandinavian or in
Swedish,
Swedish, sorry, language. Which, again, you know, for authenticity was good, but doesn't really help if you're looking to sell it. And then so that one they kind of made a cock upon, and then there was the one that was it Jude Law who was in it. He played Match Point. Was that?
Yeah. I never saw it because someone told me it was so bad.
Yeah, it's not great. And then even the documentaries that they have made. Again, there was the one about McEnroe and Lendl, I think, at the French Open not so long ago, but it was all done in like weird camera angles and this kind of thing. And it's like, come on, somebody just come up with a good... There's storylines to be had. Even the McEnroe documentary that came out a couple of years ago was all right, but they could have made there's a brilliant McEnroe documentary to be made just about his career. But, and I'm not being dismissive of like mental health and that kind of thing, but it really dwelled, it really wanted to get into his mental health and that kind of bit thing. But I just kind of wanted to watch a documentary about John McEnroe's career, you know, just about the tennis career he had. And they somehow just managed to keep messing it up as a sport.
I was going to say, we're probably coming up to that time of year, aren't we, where we maybe should take some recommendations for something to watch and do a little
review. The BBC
episode.
Ones that they did last year were very good, I thought. They did around Wimbledon. They did one on McEnroe Borg. I think they did one on Everton Martina, I think. And there was one on Federer and Nadal, I think.
Yeah, let us know if you've got recommendations of things we should watch on tennis where you think the tennis is half decent, or things that are about tennis and are half decent. Tennisunfiltered@gmail.com. We will try and watch them all. That VS documentary that we watched a few years ago on Netflix is excellent, by the way. I hope it's still on there, but it's very, very good. That is in Spanish, to be fair, so Calvin will hate it. But
no, it was good. That was good. It stuck to the, it had a storyline, though, didn't it, that one? It had a story. This is what it's about. We're going to tell you the story about how he was screwed on the rankings. And, you know, it was in Spanish, but it didn't bother me. Like, just go with the stories. There are stories there. Stop trying to be too arty.
namby-pamby wokeism on the back of the shirt, isn't it?
Yeah, make sure you have the right flags as well. That's the most important thing.
You joke, but I very nearly did a story. I didn't do it at the end because it was a bit too, frankly, boring. But someone came up to me outside the press centre at the Australian Open this year and said, "I have a story for you." And I was like, "Oh no!" He started off with the phrase, "Are you a journalist?" And I was like, "That's never a question you want to say yes to." Like, I was just like, "Maybe." And he says, "I have a story for you." And I was like, "Okay, great." He's like, "Come see Flag." And I was like, "Flags, amazing. Like, Flag basically saved my career 14 months ago. So come see, I want to see this flag." And he goes to like this little parade of flags around the back of the Kia Arena. And he's like, "You see that flag there?" And I was like, "Yeah, that's, is it Czech Republic or should we call it Chechnya?" He's like, "It's my country." And I was like, "Okay." He's like, "Do you not see?" And I was like, "No." He's like, "It's upside down." And I was like... Oh, no. I was like, "Oh, of course it is. How did I not notice?" So I texted, I thought, "Oh, it's just not, you know, it's just not a big story, is it?" And I texted a mate at Tennis Australia. I was like, by the way, I'm not doing this, but the Czech flag's upside down outside. Like, you know, you better sort it out." And he was like, "Oh, yeah, thanks. Actually, we will." And apparently someone had said the day before that it was upside down, when it was the right way up, and they turned it upside down. So then they had to turn it back the right way up.
I mean, you say it's not a story, but imagine that happened in Britain. Nigel Farage would get a month of publicity out of that.
Well, yeah, exactly.
I was actually thinking the other day that, like with when there was all this flag stuff, that it might, remember when Murray said that at the... It was so much of a different time then, and he still got a lot of stick about it then, when he said that, I think it was, he hoped that Paraguay beat England.
Oh, like, the anyone but like, England comments, yeah.
And it was a joke. Like, imagine in this like discourse now, like it would be all over that they'd be discussing it in Parliament, 100% if he said it. And he got a load of stick for it then, which was ridiculous because it was a joke.
There are still people. I remember watching the US Open final, and like I was at boarding school at the time, and like some other people came. I was like one of the only Scots, because I'm half Scottish. People don't believe me. And people would come in and be like, "I hope he loses." I'm like, why? It's like, "Oh, because he said he wouldn't support England." And like, even now, people still hold it against him. It was a long journey to win that back.
And it was a joke. That was the thing. It was just a joke that, like, he said, because he's obviously Scottish. He cracked a joke. Like, it's like one of my mates who's like, one of my mates still says it now, and he's a massive Chef Wednesday fan. And I always bring it up to him. I was like, what would you say? It's like, he's from Sheffield. And I was like, what would you say if Sheffield United were playing somebody in the FA Cup final and they asked you who you wanted to win?
Yeah.
Like, then would that make you like non-patriotic or whatever it is for Sheffield? I don't know. But like, you know, you just, other team, football teams have rivals.
Yeah. And it was completely bonkers. And imagine being in Scotland and saying you hoped England won. I assure you, having watched many major tournaments in Scotland, people do not want England to win on any level.
I mean, on a bigger scheme of things, though, I think that really shows what, you know, how Andy Murray was just different, and maybe like from a different era of that. He's probably the last of that era, because I think now, James, genuinely, with PR as it is now, if it happened, I think there'd be some politically correct answer to it. You know, I don't think if we did get another Scottish player came through now, I don't think that they would say what Andy Murray did. I think they'd probably go, you know, well, you know, we're all British, and I think it'd be really great to see England win it, and they'd take the hit from Scotland, and some PR person would say, don't you dare criticise England.
I think you're probably right, sadly. Right, let's crack on with the order of play, shall we? I think we've managed to string 40 minutes out before we actually get to what we were planning on talking about. Well, first of all, it's always difficult to sort of segue from kind of having fun to some quite serious stuff. People will have heard the little extra note I recorded last week before the show, because the news broke as we were recording about Konstantin Koltsov, who we now know was Aryna Sabalenka's ex-boyfriend at the time, that he tragically died long before his time, I think it's reasonable to say. Amazingly and very surprisingly, Aryna Sabalenka still played on at the Miami Open. She beat Paula Badosa in her opening round, but then was beaten by Angelina Kalinina. I think pretty obviously affected by what was going on in her personal life. There's an investigation ongoing into Konstantin Koltsov's death, but it's a suspected suicide, I believe. At least that's what the Miami Police Department have said so far. I don't know if there is much more to say, or if anyone needs or wants to say anything more, but our thoughts obviously are with everyone involved. I mean, he has a youngish family, he has an ex-wife, he has friends, I'm sure. I didn't think Konstantin Koltsov was necessarily good news, but for that to happen is pretty harrowing for anyone, and I'm amazed that Aryna Sabalenka decided to go out and keep playing, because, I mean, maybe... what else do you do, right? Like, you're a professional tennis player, just play tennis. But I thought right that we should mention it and pay our small tribute to what was a clearly a very difficult week for one of the world's best tennis players. There was a comeback for Simona Halep, which was not as controversial, but certainly as newsworthy. She, of course, has been serving she served a suspension for testing positive for a substance. She was then found to have not deliberately ingested that substance by the appeal, which she took all the way to the Court of Arbitration for Sport. She played Paula Badosa in her opening match and lost in three sets. Georgie, no bad thing to have Simona Halep back on tour. Just set the doping to one side for a second. We can come on to some of the doping-related comments. But no bad thing to have someone like her back on tour, is there? I mean, it's another kind of storyline, another strand to various tournaments.
Yeah, definitely. and even kind of not setting the context aside, there's always that kind of level of intrigue around like a kind of, you know, there is always kind of split camps on this sort of thing, and we'll kind of come on to that. But yeah, I mean, look, Halep is someone who's won multiple Grand Slams. She's won kind of famous Grand Slams against kind of Serena Williams, where she absolutely put her to the sword at Wimbledon. I don't know which year that was now. 2020, 2021? 2019?
It would be 2019 because she wasn't able to come out as defending champion. There was that whole thing.
Yeah. So people know who she is. She's a big name. Obviously, in her home country of Romania, she's absolutely massive and really well known. But I think she's known to kind of a lot broader audiences as well. Particularly after that match. I mean, it's obviously hard to escape the broader context, and I think that always makes the story far more interesting. It's, you know, it's not had the same media coverage as, say, like the Sharapova return, but it's certainly probably the closest high-profile thing we've had since that, I'd say. And I don't want to say doping's ever a good thing for the sport, but from a covering it perspective, it does bring about a bit of interest, and particularly when you've got, I think, Caroline Wozniacki on the tour, who's always very willing to have some pop shots, shall we say.
Yeah, for people who missed this, Caroline Wozniacki talking about players who are coming back from doping suspensions, being given wildcards. She said, if you want to come back, and it's been a mistake, I understand, you should work your way up from the bottom. Simone Halep's response was, yeah, but why? I didn't do anything wrong. I didn't cheat. I didn't dope. So it's better if we read the decision from CAS that it was contaminated supplement. It wasn't doping. I never had something to do with doping. I never doped. I'm not a cheater. Thank you to the tournament for giving me a wild card. Only one person being negative about me is not that important because I have hundreds of people that have given me love. So I will take that. Some added context that Simona Halep may have forgotten about was that when Maria Sharapova made her own comeback, I believe Simona Halep also thought that it was a bit unfair that she should be getting wild cards having been served a ban for. And it should be noted, Maria Sharapova, just like Halep, was given a she's not a cheat verdict by CAS. Maria Sharapova was found to have taken a substance that had previously been not banned and then became banned, and she kept taking it, and they said, oh no, you did do that accidentally. So Calvin, is it unfair when people have been banned over doping offences or, you know, substances, banned substances, get wild cards on their way back?
I mean, I think it is, but I also think it's difficult to judge on this one because of the nature of the outcome of the decision, that, you know, she did serve a ban. Even CAS didn't absolve her of any doping or anything. They said it was a 9-month ban that she'd already served.
Hmm.
So, you know, that's for her to say, I wasn't cheating, I wasn't doping, then the actual decision stressed that she was.
Well, I mean, I think there's a semantics issue going on here, right? Like, she did ingest a banned substance. It wasn't deliberate doping. She had it in her system.
But then, you know, we keep hearing about strict liability and that kind of thing. So, you know, I don't know where you go on that. And as well, as we know, because I think in your excellent piece the other week, James, we spoke to a coach who whose player didn't have the money to go and fight it, and he just had to serve the ban.
Mm.
So basically, Halep has got to that place because she's been able to throw a lot of money at it. I still feel uncomfortable about the whole situation. I still think there are still some questions to be answered on it, which we probably won't ever get answered now because I think the case is closed. I'm still a bit uncomfortable when cases go to CAS because I think that basically money talks in that situation, that if you've got the money to keep taking it to those to as high as it can go at CAS, history shows that they will probably favour the athlete on those instances. And there have been players who haven't had the money to be able to do that in the last year who have had to just serve the whole ban.
Mm.
I do think there is the flip side of that. I think there is issues with certain other players. For example, I know Tara Moore, who is one of those players who can't afford to fight it through CAS and what have you, and she's been absolved of all guilt. She took a contaminated meat. She just has to start back at where her rankings drop to. She doesn't even get protected ranking. And I think in that situation, you should have a retrospective protected ranking, for sure.
Yeah, it seems like an obvious thing that you can give people to give them a protected ranking, you know. And if you get found guilty of having, you know, deliberately doped, then of course you lose that protected ranking.
It's a bit of a bigger question because, like, say, for example, that it's up to the tournaments who they give the wild cards to anyway. Like, that's one of the issues with wild cards, as we discussed a couple of weeks ago about doubles and that kind of thing in Dubai. Tournaments can give wildcards to whoever they want to.
Mm.
Look at it the other way. What does it help if we make Simona Halep go down and play? I assume she's still playing very, very good tennis. Mm. I assume she's been training for some time and she's still legitimate top 10 in the world player. What does it help if we send her down to play some 25Ks and some 15Ks? There's going to be girls there who are going to be playing her, who are trying to make a career out of it. They might have spent all the money they've got on making a 3-week trip to some 25Ks, and it's legitimate you could get Simona Halep first round in all three. And I don't really get what that helps in the grand scheme of things. The awarding of wild cards to Halep is not something I have the biggest issue with in all of this situation. I think that's my position on it.
So I suppose you'd say it's more about kind of the earnings Halep just can automatically walk back into, you know, getting automatic entry into kind of big events where she you know, obviously by merit, by getting there, can really kind of get good earnings because she's a good player. But I think that would be the flip point, wouldn't it? Like, yes, she could deny some people lower down the rankings their thing, but actually she could deny, earn a crap load of money that maybe she...
I guess if it's in wildcards, though, George, I keep maintaining, this is, I say this all the time, nobody deserves a wildcard because a wildcard, if you deserve to be in the tournament, you'd be in there on ranking. So I don't think you can argue that, well, she's depriving somebody else of that money because they would need a wildcard as well. But you are depriving a legitimate, you know, if somebody who's trying to get up to into the top 100 and where, you know... What is she allowed a wild card into? Because she has no ranking. So if she didn't get a wild card at all, she'd have to go and play qualies in 15Ks. And who does that
help? That's what we want to see. That's the documentary.
But, you know, who? I just don't get who that helps.
Is that that's actually... I really realise that's a question I don't know the answer. Is that if you have a zero ranking, is that what you can... Is that what you have to try and get into?
Yeah, that's what you've got. And you can't always get in them. If it goes to a situation where those draws are full, then and there's people with one ITF point or something like that, then you don't get in. You know, it's, I think now you can pretty much get in any tournament, but that's where she would have to start. 15K qualies.
Well, George, sounds like you can get in some 15K qualies.
Well, I know. I think that's the great Tennis Unfiltered documentary we all want to see. Calvin taking me out coaching for
a... You were going to do it once, weren't you, George?
We were going to do it. Yeah, I think in my last days in Metro, I was going to do it.
Do you have to pay to enter these tournaments? I presume you do.
Yeah, you do now. You didn't have to. You didn't used to. There used to be. Now, what it was, you only had to pay to enter qualies. If you were in Maine, there wasn't an entry fee.
Right.
But they've changed it now.
To stop people like George just rocking up.
It wasn't. It's not much. It's like 40 quid, I think, or something like that.
George, I will sign that check right now. Get you into every 15K qualies there is in Britain.
I want to play Skippy. It's the match we all want.
But no, yeah. I mean, that's my position on it. I get the moral and ethical position of it, but I don't really see who it helps if you're sending Simona Halep down to, you know, spend 6 months beating girls who are trying to make an honest living out of this when, you know, she's one of the legitimate top 10 players in the world.
Mm. Right, let's move on. We were going to talk about Annie Murray, but fortunately we already have a fair bit. What about Dan Evans? Because when we were talking about fun matchups, yeah, don't puff your cheeks out like that, George. When we were talking about fun matchups earlier in the show, I was going to suggest Evans-Sonego as a very fun matchup. A, because Dan Evans finally beat him. And I don't think it's ever been straight sets. And I find Lorenzo Sonego a very entertaining person to watch, because you don't, George.
No, I was actually just going to say, now you've said that, I would watch Evans-Mute over many other matchups on the ATP Tour. That is always a banger for not really tennis reasons.
I mean, there are quite a few people on tour in tennis who could start a fight in an empty room. And I think on his day, Dan Evans is one of them. I really like Evo, but when he's in a mood, he definitely could start a fight on his own. And Lorenzo Sonego is always in a mood, so it's just a match made in heaven. But yeah, Evans picking up a win in the first round and then beaten by Christopher Eubanks in quite a tight and disappointing loss. Calvin, he had match point and everything.
Yeah, I mean, the match point's got quite a bit of viewing on various social media outlets, hasn't it? Must have seen it 200 times over the last day. I don't know how Evo will react to that. I do know he does have social media, although claims he doesn't. yeah, he will have seen quite a lot of that, I think. So, and the nature of the match point will haunt him somewhat, I would think.
So for people who haven't seen it, it's a put away forehand with Eubanks outside the doubles tram lines, right? Like
it's not outside the doubles. He's in the middle of the court.
Oh, does he get back in? Okay, yeah. But he has recovered from outside the doubles tram lines, like having made a limping return. And I mean, he guesses right? Like Evans tries to go back behind him, he guesses right and makes the forehand. What should he have done better, Calvin?
Well, I mean, there's two ways of looking at it. Simon Briggs messaged me yesterday, I think he was writing a piece on it or something about what happens. And the way that you would approach that shot, the way that I would coach somebody to approach it, when you've got that type of shot, which you call a finishing volley, you treat it like a penalty at football. And you basically, by that, you know, there's various ways of taking a penalty, but the ways that always advise is you pick a side and you hit it hard. And so on that basis, you can say he didn't do much wrong. He picked a side and he hit it hard. Eubanks guessed right and he played a freak shot.
It's a great
to
shot.
Make it. I think also what hasn't gone unsaid is that I think Evans stopped as well. I don't think it's unreasonable that if he knew he was going to get there, he could have got there and made the volley. But he kind of like didn't, or he sort of, there's a little bit where I wonder whether he can even still get there, but he leaves it, I think. Maybe thinks it's going wide, but I don't know. But so that's one way of looking at it, going, look, you know, you've got to, it's going to happen one time in every 50. That sort of thing is going to happen. If it's not match point, you don't forget about it. He picked a side and he hit it hard relatively into the corner. And he got away with it. Now, what I would say the other way, if I'm going to argue the other side of that, is I had no idea why he went running forehand. Because if he hits it hard to Eubanks' backhand, which isn't a great backhand, there's no way he makes it. Because the thing is with the backhand as well, is that if he goes there, it's a shorter area because the ball was on Evo's forehand side. If you do that and you hit it hard into the backhand, the only place that Eubank can go is down the line off a backhand. Because the ball would be coming in at such pace, he wouldn't be able to get his racket round it and put it cross court. So you can hit it hard and just cover the line. And even worst case scenario, you're going to have the put away volley. And so you would say in one way you go, pick a side, doesn't matter, pick a side, commit to it, hit it hard, and you'll win the point more often. But the other side, I don't know why he picked that side. And the thing is that I know Evo, I've watched matches with him. He loves when something like that happens, he'd have been there going, oh, why has he done that? What an idiot. Why has he gone to his forehand there? But, you know, it happens.
I wanted him to do the Panenko Kelvin and really kind of stand out. Little drop shot out of nowhere.
Yeah, but no, I mean, I think it's one of those that I think even if he does that, he wins that point 98 times out of 100. Because it's still Eubanks being able to hit that chip forehand up the line is a tough shot to make and get it up the little tunnel of space that he found it in.
It means the Brit Challenge in Miami is over before the first second week begins. Somehow these Masters events are now 2 week events. Jack Draper knocked out by Nicholas Jarry. Dan Evans, as we mentioned, beaten by Christopher Eubanks. Cam Norrie pretty soundly beaten by Daniil Medvedev. Norrie really is starting to lose a lot of ground in the rankings. He's down to 31 in the world now. He's not far off losing British number one status because Jack Draper won a round and with so few points to defend in the middle of the year, he is up to 38 in the world and Dan Evans is 41. So there could be some changing of the guard going on in the next couple of months, you would think. I'd tell you someone else who might overtake Cam Norrie in the rankings is Fabian Marojan. Sorry, Calvin, you wanted to come in there.
I was just going to say, I don't know if you can find it. It's an interesting question that what has been the lowest that a British number one has been ranked for some time?
Well, I mean, there have been some really bad.
No, yeah, I mean, in the past, yeah, but I'm talking since Murray came through, because I'm thinking like when Murray came and then when Murray got injured, then wasn't Evo maybe up towards 25-ish, you know? And
that was because Evans kind of... Didn't Evans make the final in Australia early 2017? And then obviously Murray went by the end of 2017.
Yeah, so I think we've always had somebody, I would say, in the top 30. We could be approaching a point where... I mean, it won't be for long because Drapes will make top 30, top 20, top 10 soon. So but it could be like a moment where this is the lowest the number British number one has been ranked for some time.
I mean, I would guess 31 is probably the lowest for 3 years, I would say, at least. If not,
and he's 31 now, is he, Noz?
Yeah, Norrie, yeah.
Right, okay, yeah, could be, yeah.
Yeah, which, I mean, the thing is that there's an exponential kind of thing there where you drop outside the seedings at Grand Slams, all of a sudden, like, you start getting some really tough draws in the early rounds of Slams, you know, the sort of Murray moment. Things start to get very difficult. Equally, on the flip side, for someone like Draper, he is only probably four places off getting seeded at the French Open. He has virtually no points to defend on the clay.
It's like one of those that I know that Hiltz had told me when he was coaching Evo that Evo got that obsession with trying to get seeded at the slams, but if you get one of those low seeding spots, it also means you're getting one of the top four players world in the third round. Yeah. So it's almost like a lot of the time taking a bit of a punt and not getting seeded and thinking, well, I'd rather take on...
You'd rather be 33 than 32. Yeah.
Depending, you know.
Mm. Yeah, well, we'll see how they go. But yeah, no more Brits left. Fabian Marojan, probably not a name anyone's thought about since he beat Carlos Alcaraz in Rome. I thought, looking at the stats, that he might have had another one of those days and turned up and hit 23 winners and only 8 unforced errors, but... we see from social media that Holger Rune wasn't feeling great, so I don't know whether this match has much to talk about after all that. But George, maybe there's nothing to note.
Well, I think it's just kind of classic Rune anyway, isn't it? Just wasn't very magnanimous, was it?
he lost 6-1, 6-1, didn't he?
Didn't even mention the opponent once. Like, there wasn't any. You know, it's normally when you get that kind of thing, it's like, you know, but well done, fully deserved. Basically, put it all down to it.
I mean. I've said it before, I'll say it again. The tour needs shithouses. And if Holger Rune wants to say, I'd have smashed that guy if I wasn't feeling like crap. I've been on the toilet all night. It's embarrassing that he let me win 2 games. I'm all for it, quite frankly. Say what he likes. Marojan's one of these players. I mean, is he a Karatsev where, like, it's just, you know, if he gets on a hot streak for 6 months and he's going to... Because he's into the... He's into the fourth round. He's got Alex de Minaur, so we'll see how that goes. And that match may have finished by the time you hear this. But is he just one of those players who's he's going to have a run, go on a tear somewhere and beat a whole load of players?
I mean, I don't think he's quite as streaky as Karatsev was. Mm. I think he's quite got that in the locker where he can just blow away anybody. But, you know, he's certainly a talented player. I think he'll be around. You know, I think he'll always have decent results.
Hmm. Picked up a few wins in Indian Wells as well. So clearly liking the American hard court. Beat Nicolas Jarry, Thiago Seybotch-Wilt, another very streaky player.
I mean, I think one of the things that... Well, I don't know whether we get onto it, but again with the ATP, like how they managed to make these weird decisions. Like, because apparently the conditions in Miami and Indian Wells completely different.
Hmm.
Like different balls.
Well, they're using a different ball as well.
Different ball, and the court in Indian Wells apparently exceptionally slow, and in Miami it's very fast. So
crazy again, so for back-to-back, you know, back-to-back Masters events.
I mean, I wouldn't mind it so much if they play the same ball.
Yeah,
because I think it's variations good. I don't think you should just have the same surface on everything, and then we are going into clay. But again, just like, how have you got to this situation? I don't get, you know, how we've ended up in that position.
You know what George is going to say. Get rid of Indian Wells. The Belshaw axe to grind comes out once again. The only other note I wanted to make from the men's draw is the battle of the single-handers between Denis Shapovalov and Stefanos Tsitsipas. Came out in favour of Denis Shapovalov, which is not something we've said an awful lot in the last 12 or 24 months. How good would it be, George, if we had Denis Shapovalov back on the tear on the men's tour? I mean, I know we've sort of stopped talking about him because we kept having the same conversation about him, but he's winning matches now, so let's get excited.
He's already lost.
Yeah, but he's winning some matches. He won 2 matches. I reckon that's more Masters matches than he's won in the last 2 years, without looking it up. George, get excited about it, please.
Well, I mean, look, I loved watching Shapovalov when he was kind of in his pomp, and it was, you know, very exciting when he first came through and beat Rafa, who's had some big match wins, reached, was it semis at Wimbledon or quarters? Semis, wasn't it?
Hmm.
I think he's got a great game style to watch. Like, I know he's can be brain dead or whatever, but, you know, the jumping one-handed backhand off a left-hand side is cool. Like, you know, he is someone who looks interesting. I know Calvin's
rolling his eyes almost audibly.
It's the opposite of what Calvin will want in the sport in terms of, you know, he's a...
It's not that I don't want it. It's James, George, it's not that I don't want it. It's just not a very good shot.
I know, it's just fun, Calvin. It's just fun. It's not very good.
Then the shots that he does, he can put away. It's like people think it's an actual shot that he has as a weapon.
No, it's not. I'm not calling it a weapon, but I think it's that style, that bit of finesse and fun that makes you want to watch the sport in some ways. Like, he's a different player, isn't he? He's good. There's no one out there's no one out there who else has a one-handed backhand who jumps about a bit on the left-hand side. And yeah, I think he's definitely someone you want up there, and he's recognisable with the kind of blonde hair and backwards cap or whatever he wears now these days.
Doesn't wear it now. Got short hair, hasn't he?
Well, that's a big loss.
No, I mean, I'm all pro. I'm sort of hoping the backwards cap era might have had its day.
I mean, I say this all the time, and I know people tennis players who I get on really well with, I'm friends with. There's something just bizarre about grown men wearing backwards caps. Like, it's just really strange. And in the doubles as well, there's some guys like in their 40s who are doing it. I'm like, lads, come on.
Did Patton and Cash not go through a backwards hat?
Jules wears a backwards hat. Okay. I mean, Henry did as well, but it was like, that's because they were, and I think they still do. They have some help from a guy who's like sort of a scientist on the weights and distributions and that kind of thing. And he figured that having a cap on like adds weight or something, but it was a small period. But Henry like did not look good with the backwards cap on. But
sorry, I would really like to meet the man who's going to make an argument to me that there's a scientific reason for wearing a backwards cap.
I've had discussions and my thoughts have been made on
Is there like a kind of a timeline for when Shapovalov stopped wearing his backwards cap and his form just suddenly dropped?
I don't know. No, he had his haircut. But no, the thing what behind it all is that, like, if you have weight somewhere, you have to balance it somewhere else.
Right.
And what these guys wanted to do, they're always making the racket heavier, and they were like, well, now we've made the racket heavy, we need to add some bracelets and some wristbands and some caps. And I'm like, well, just don't make the racket any heavier. Like that would be the... And it got like, I think it got too much. Like, we were talking about, like, they could only wear collared shirts, then they were not allowed to wear collared shirts. And, like, there was an instance where one of the guys was like, one of the guys used to go to tournaments a lot with them, and then I was at a tournament, I think it might have been in Delray or something, and I was like, he was messaging me, and, like, because I message him when he was traveling, and I'd say, you know, tell Henry and Jules to like mainly go to this guy's backhand, try a bit more eye formation that. And he messaged me at one of the tournaments going, go and tell Henry to change his socks.
My God.
But then it got the other side, because like then he was like, I remember there's one tournament they were playing where they were like, it was roasting like somewhere. It was absolutely, you know, there's sweat pouring off them. But they've been told that under no circumstance could you change any one item of clothing, you had to change the whole thing or the balance would go or something like that. And I was like, this is getting ridiculous. Like, they're playing in dripping wet clothes on the premise that they can't go and get... I mean, some of the stuff was mad. Like there was an instance with a watch at Wimbledon, like where they told one of them to wear a watch because it balanced up the right hand side or something, and then he was worried that they wouldn't let him. The scientist guy was worried that they wouldn't let him play in the watch because it was black, so he went and spent a fortune on a white Lacoste watch in London.
No,
my goodness. Like it was crazy, but you know what do I know?
You don't know the percentage chances.
They won a lot of matches.
There, we do know that. Just finally, we've not talked much about the women's draw in Miami, so maybe we should mention it. Naomi Osaka beaten by Caroline Garcia again. I feel like Garcia versus Osaka is one of those matches where I want them both to win, because I think it would be good for tennis if they're both, because they both play good tennis to watch, and I'm very keen on that. And also, good win for Katie Bolter over Beatriz Hadamaya, albeit I'm reticent to talk too much about that because I note she's currently 4 points away from going out against Victoria Azarenka, trailing 7-5, 5-5 love. Beatriz Hadamaya is a bit of a funny one, George. I feel like she's sort of clinging on to top 10, but without having really done anything for a while.
Yeah, I mean, I think there was a little bandwagon of people who were very excited about kind of had Admire's rise and how she had really kind of turned the corner and was going to be a huge threat at slams and stuff. And I've always been like, I believe it when I actually see it in that sort of setting. I think she's a good player. I don't think she's anything particularly to
right home about him in the long run. And I think that's, you know, she's a very, very good player in terms of you have to be very, very good to get to the top ends of the rankings in any of these sports. But I've always been a bit skeptical of like how high her suspect she's already hit it. So yeah, I think Bolter, good win, but sort of a win against someone who I think's above where they could or should be.
Damning indictment there, George. Very, you'll never be able to walk around Brazil ever again. They'll take it very personally. I think that's probably all we need to cover, George. Is there anything else you wanted to cover? Any other business that you feel somehow in our hour and a half long nonsense we've failed to cover?
Don't think so.
Great news. Bye. No, thank you very much for listening. Thank you for leaving a rating and a review, as I know many of you have. Please send us more questions. We'll do our best to answer them. As you can tell, we like questions. We tend to go off on tangents quite easily. So please ask us anything and everything. Let us know if you ever watched that Bisham Abbey documentary in Channel 4. But most importantly, please do come back next week.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Sports Social Podcast Network.